Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone who's joining us here for our weekly show, The Tenpenny Files on Your Health. For the last 24 years or so, I've literally given thousands of radio and television interviews, but most of the time they've been on vaccines. But as a board-certified physician, there's so many more things to talk about on your health. So we set up this show so that we could bring you things that you aren't generally going to hear in a lot of other places to really address issues that you have about your health. Today, my special guest is our monthly update with Twyla Braze, the co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Zeolite is a detox spray. We work specifically with a company called Touchstone Essentials. They are an incredible company. We've been working with them now for several years. And zeolite is a mineral that goes through your body like a one-way basket. It will clean out heavy metals such as arsenic and mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and it hooks onto those metals from a one-way perspective. So once it's bound, it goes out through your urine or your stools and doesn't get redeposited in other places. Everybody needs to have a detox product in their life, and this one is so easy to use, and it's so safe. You can take it when you're pregnant. You can take it when you're nursing. You can give it to little children. You can even give it to infants, and quite frankly, I give it to my dog. I actually put a little bit of the zeolite in his water because until we all stop living in a toxic world, we all need to get some of those extra toxicities out, the heavy metals, the persistent organic pollutants, the things that are floating through the air, the different things that we come in touch with in our environment. And we are a big fan of zeolite from Touchstone Essentials. We've been a big, big, big fan of their products for several years. Go to drtenpenny.com/detox to get your first bottle of zeolite spray for $50 off. Well, welcome back, everyone. Twyla Braze is the president and co-founder of the Citizens Council for Health Freedom, CCHF, a patient-centered, privacy-focused policy organization established in Minnesota more than 27 years ago to protect patient and doctor freedom. Her efforts have led to amazing results, including the development of the Wedge of Health Freedom and the Patient Toolbox, easy-to-use tools to help patients understand their options in coercive situations and to maintain control over their treatment decisions. On a broader scale, Twyla's Health Freedom Minute is heard daily by more than 5 million listeners on more than 870 radio stations in 48 states. Amid all that, she's written a book called Big Brother in the Exam Room, The Dangerous Truth About Electronic Medical Records. It was written in 2018, but it's more accurate and more important now than ever. So Twyla, and all of your busy stuff, I'm so grateful that you come and spend time with us once a month on the Tenpenny Files. Thank you for coming back again this evening.
Well, it's always a joy to be here. It's great to talk to your listeners.
Well, great. You know, on your monthly update tonight, I wanted to start by talking about your new Medicare how-to guide that you just released. And tell us a little bit about it. What makes it so unique?
Well, it's really unique because of what's in it. So it's not like any other guide. It's for example, one of the big things that's not in any other guide is the 10 Medicare traps. Now, there might be more than 10 Medicare traps, but I chose to pick the ones that are most obvious, most concerning, the ones that people really need to know when they're making their Medicare decision. In addition to that, we have an extensive list of definitions. So if you're wondering what anything means or anything comes back with the Medicare forms, you can look into there and see if that will help you. We have questions for your Medicare agents in order to figure out, are they working for you or are they really, you know, working on behalf of a Medicare Advantage plan? We've got a section that's just called Original Medicare versus Medicare Advantage, just to help you make a decision about, you know, what you should do. And then we have a 12-point summary. So, you know, I think we write something in there like, for those of you who just want to read something short, this section is for you. So it's just 12 points on two pages that you can look at and see if you want to delve any further after you've read those 12 points. So we've got different things in there that nobody else has. We also have a checklist. So go through the checklist. We've got something on TRICARE. TRICARE is a really big deal. I discovered that Medicare Advantage agents are trying to trick people to going into TRICARE folks to going into Medicare Advantage, and they absolutely should not. And this explains why.
Wow. And tell people where they can find the guide.
Sure. It is at cchfreedom.org, cchfreedom.org. It's free to be downloaded. Your support for our work would be great at the same time, but it's absolutely free for everybody because we want to protect everybody from the dangers of Medicare until we can get to a better system, like, you know, real health insurance for everybody that's affordable.
Do you think that's ever going to happen?
That is one of my goals in life. Because the fact of the matter is the Affordable Care Act took away real insurance for everybody else. When you turn 65, most insurance companies, or actually health plans, they're not insurance companies. Most health plans will kick you out. And if you quit working, you're liable to lose your employer sponsor coverage. And so you have no choice except Medicare. And, you know, in 2019, we, after 3 years of trying, we got the Trump administration, President Trump, to get us an executive order to let people opt out of Medicare and keep their Social Security benefits. Those two got tied together by the Clintons in an operations manual. It's not a law. It's not a rule. It's not a nothing except an instruction that the Clintons put in there. And so we want to undo that so that people have a choice and so that we can have a real market. There will be 80 million people in Medicare. Imagine what kind of a private market there could be for affordable real insurance that pays you. And then you pick your doctor, you pick your hospital, and nobody gets in between. And everything is less expensive because there aren't all those third-party fingers.
What was the thinking behind, if there was any thinking, you know, if there was any thinking, but what was the thought process, let's just use that, behind tying Social Security and Medicare together?
Well, you know, this happened in 1993, and you know that Hillary was, you know, at the helm of moving us toward a national healthcare system. Bill Clinton's bill was called the National Health Security Act, and it would have nationalized healthcare. And the last thing I believe that Hillary wanted, or Bill, would be to have let people have a way out of Medicare. So people were sending letters, it appears, to the Social Security Administration saying that they wanted to get out of Medicare because they had a better secondary insurance that would give them better coverage, right? And then I think that their response was to write this into the operations manual and just to seal everybody in by saying, no, you can't have your Social Security benefits if you don't get Medicare. When this went to court, the lawsuit was filed in 2008 by people who wanted to get out of Medicare and use their secondary coverage. When this went to court, one of the things that happened was that Brett Kavanaugh, head of the appeals court at that time, wrote a terrible decision that said you cannot unentitle yourself to Medicare. And he ruled against these individuals. But there was a brilliant dissent written by Judge Karen Henderson, which said, first of all, Kavanaugh never answered the question because they didn't want to unentitle themselves. They wanted to disenroll. They just wanted to disenroll, just like with Medicaid. You can be entitled to Medicaid, but you don't have to be in there, right? So they wanted to do the same thing, and he never responded to the actual purpose of the lawsuit. So she wrote that he didn't do that, but then she also said there's nothing in law anywhere that ties these two together. So, you know, when Trump got in 2016, I looked at this whole thing and said, now is the time. I think we can get Trump to do an executive order to let people out of Medicare and now build a market, a huge market that would be waiting to just draw people away to real insurance, right? And it took 3 years. But we got it in October of 2019. But then you know what happened in 2020.
Right.
So the executive order said that a rule shall be written. And of course, COVID just kept that rule from really delayed that rule being written. It did get written. It did get to the Office of Management and Budget for possible publication in September 2020. But they waited to see if Trump would be reelected. And then when he wasn't, they didn't put it out, and then Biden rescinded it. So, you know, we will see, but we are not done with this because this is critical to getting health freedom back in this country, is to give people the right to opt out of Medicare. And they're going to need it. because Medicare is dying. And that's one of the things that I made sure was in our Medicare guide, was to show the financial situation of Medicare so that people can actually see the numbers and realize that this is a dying program and they should actually want to get out of Medicare, because rationing is the only thing that's coming along in order to try to save it politically, because Congress wants to save it. Nobody wants to be at the helm when Medicare goes away, and there's got to be a way to let them off but move people out. But they're not thinking that way, but we are.
That's really, really interesting, because, you know, we've talked about that a lot in this show, about the dying part of Medicare, that there's just not going to be enough money for the number of enrollees that they're putting in there. And so do you think let's say if Trump gets elected, do you think Bobby Kennedy would be a person to appeal this to, if he's going to be talking about the MAHA thing and making America healthy again? Would his ear be the one to bend if he were in office?
Well, anybody who has a position in the administration with any power, or, you know, any sway with President, now former President Trump, but if he were President Trump again, right, anybody who would have any sway, we would go to. But I also think that a lot of the people that helped us during those 3 years to just move it up and up and up and up, because the last person that we had to move it to was the White House counsel, who was the first person who said, oh yeah, we can do this. Everybody else said, no, you can't do this. So we got all those people, a lot of those people will probably go back into the administration. Right. And we will not have to start from the ground floor. As a matter of fact, about a year and a half ago, one of those people, I was in D.C. and unbidden, I was asked a question about this issue. So I know it is still on their minds. And I think it would happen sooner rather than later. And we would certainly push to make that happen.
Yeah, well, you've got all the right reasons to do it. You know, it's a large market share, which that should make them all like lap at their, you know, be like Wile E. Coyote, you know, licking their lips, you know, at that. And, you know, they've got to do something to support these seniors, because there's more and more and more of them. Is the number still correct? When, you know, this number came out a while ago, where they said like 10,000 people a day in this country are turning 65 and rolling over into Medicare. Is that number still accurate?
10,000 baby boomers a day. And that will end either in 2030 or in 2031. But all those baby boomers will be in there for a longer period of time than, you know, people used to be, because I don't think people understand this, although if they thought about it, they probably would. But the number of centurions, the people who are 100 and over, this population by percentage is growing the fastest of any population in the United States. So wow. If you get in to Medicare at age 65, right, and you're still living at age 105, we're talking about 40 years where you're thinking that your piddly, and I will say piddly, payroll tax for Medicare is going to cover that entire length of your time, hospitalizations, surgeries, and everything else. And one of the things that I talk about in the guide, that it was actually co-written, but I'm one of the writers. One of the things is that the fact of the matter is that studies show that Medicare recipients get three times the amount of care in dollars as they put into the program. So that when seniors say, well, you know, I paid all my life into this, I deserve it. And it's like, you did. You paid into it, but you paid only a pittance compared to what it actually cost today. So that's one of the reasons why it's dying. And one of the statistics in the guide, which a lot of people don't know, is in 2022. So just 2 years ago, the federal government paid $905 billion for Medicare. But there was $54 billion of that was over the amount of money that came in 2022. So it was, they paid $54 billion more than the revenue that came in to support the program. Well, you can't do that in your house.
You know,
You
and
can't
this
do that
and there
anywhere.
and there's so many complexities to that. I mean, first of all, just go back historically. You know, when they enacted Medicare, the life expectancy, the average life expectancy was around 67. And now it's 78 and into the 80s. And now you're even saying even more into the hundreds. And then the cost of healthcare dollars itself, and physicians are, you know, they're just so afraid of being sued for missing something. So it's almost like because we can, we do. You know, it's not like, you know, we should think about what we're doing, you know, and there was just a really good Substack. I haven't read the whole thing this morning that I just saw, but the title of it, well, the title of the Substack was, Should Physicians Work to Save Life at All Cost? You know, and you know, there was a really good book that I read. This is a few years ago. I think the name of it was something like, I can't remember. I remember what the name of it was, but it was written by a rheumatologist, and it was basically saying at that time that by the time you reach 85 years of age, we should quit with the massive medical care stuff. We should keep people comfortable. We should keep people out of pain. We should do what we can to make them functional, but they should live their life to be happy and to enjoy their children and their grandchildren and gardening and things like that, and not be spending all of their time going to doctor's visits and spending all their money on doctor's visits and trying to get their cholesterol level down to where it was when you were in your 40s, because nobody really knows what a normal cholesterol should be in an 85-year-old. We just assume it should be, you know, 190 like it was when you were 40. And on and on and on and on. I mean, we could spend 2 hours just talking about that, about the complexities and the problems with elder care, and all of those things.
But what I would say is this question gets answered very quickly if people have real insurance, because if they get paid by their insurance company, they will decide what they want to use that money for, or how they're going to spend that money, or what kind of insurance do they want to have? Do they want to have, when they're 85, do they want to have something that is highly affordable and therefore doesn't cover a lot of high costs? Or do they want to leave this kind of money to their children? The thing that I think about is all of the 80 and 90 year olds that I know who are vibrant people. And the idea that someone would decide that there is an endpoint by which you're vibrant, no matter how vibrant you are, you really don't get access to care. The other thing that would be solved is what you're talking about is people going into the doctor. So there's a lot of people that go into the doctor, one, because the doctor says come, because they want to, you know, get more and more money from Medicare, because this is, you know, Medicare cheats them out of real costs. And so everything is all convoluted in the costs. And so if they can just bring you in another time, they can get a little bit more money than what Medicare is paying. But if you had real insurance, you would decide, I'm going to pay 20% of that. I'm not going to go in to the doctor's office for that. I'm not going to go in for that. Do I really need a cholesterol screening? I don't think so. And then, of course, a lot of the third-party costs would be taken out. So in essence, healthcare would be a lot less expensive if we didn't have all the third-party fingers in there. And it would be less of a threat to Medicare. And so, you know, the federal government, Congress, by having all these third-party fingers in there to control care, have actually made it extraordinarily expensive. If we gave people back their money and gave them access to real health insurance and then let charity be available to those who really need it, we would change the entire healthcare system. We'd bring all the costs down. Everything would be transparent. Doctors would work for patients again. There wouldn't be any electronic health records dictating what they can and cannot do, or trying to make them order these things so that they can bring in more money for the hospital or more money for the clinic, right? It's all screwed up because we've got all these third-party businesses in that are using the healthcare system for their own purposes. It's not about the patient anymore. It's like the patient is working for the profiteers, you know, and the political agendas. It's not working for the patients anymore.
Yeah, well, I wasn't implying that he was saying that by the time you get to be 85, you should just be tossed underneath the bus and not get health care. Oh. Things like mammograms and colonoscopies and, you know, all those expensive tests, screening, 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 screening tests. that you still get a bone density test when you're 85 years old.
Oh, I see.
If you have osteopenia or osteoporosis, well, of course you do, you know? And so those are the sorts of things that he was saying. It wasn't that if you were sick or you had a heart attack or something that people, you shouldn't get care. It's that you should get appropriate care and not inappropriate care. But all the things that you said were absolutely true. You know, we just drive up the cost of everything because. You know, it seems like it's an endless money pot, which it's not. You know, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, I think it was Emmanuel Ezekiel, right? He was part of like the Obama administration or was one of their advisors or something. There's a long, and I do mean long, an amazingly long article by him in The Atlantic several years ago where he said at age 75, you know, he was good to go. Right. But he did say somewhere in the middle of this many, many, many page article that he reserved the right to change his mind. Mm-hmm. But he had set a date by which, I mean, an age by which he thought, you know, you live long enough.
Well, you know, that is another whole complex issue, you know, about, you know, how do you define living? You know, do you define living as being in a hospital on a ventilator? Mm-hmm. Or do you define living as you can go about your life and enjoy, you know, the outside and see your grandkids? I mean, so that's another whole conversation about how you define, like, because you were saying, you know, that 85, you know, people in their 80s and 90s that are really vibrant, that is living. If you've mm-hmm. got 80 and 90 year old people with total dementia that maybe have a feeding tube, that can't get out of bed, they can't take care of themselves, is that a life? Mm-hmm. You know, and so, you know, and that is a whole other can of worms that, you know, you could argue from either side, you know, but it's complex. It's not just a straightforward issue, you know.
Well, it's complex. You know, I've often thought about this when, you know, a lot of folks in this healthcare sphere and actually in political circles essentially would like, and researchers, right? Essentially, they'd like to be God, right? They keep extending life and figuring out how to extend life, but they can't ever get past the point where we're going to die and the body does give up. And so they've achieved longer life, right? With all of these things, but then they've put a lot of people at this other point in life, right? Where other decisions have to be made because they can't be God. But I think, you know, extending is almost like trying to be God, but then they run into the wall that is called death and it's going to happen. And now what are the last few years of life going to look like as a result of all the technology, all the changes, all the research, all the drugs and everything else?
Exactly. So again, it goes back. It's a complex issue.
Yes.
It's got a lot of elements in it. No,
Medicare is a complex issue too. And I just want to say, you know, related to the guide, the whole thing is here. I did an interview this morning and the reviewer said, well, it's 60 pages. I said, yes, but the Medicare guide, the Medicare's own guide, right, is just as big as ours, but it doesn't tell you all the things that you should know to protect yourself. And so the whole thing here is, as complicated as Medicare is, and you're on a 7-month deadline to make the decision, you need to know as much as possible because some of it can impact you forever. The 10 traps are real. And so it can impact what you have to pay or what kind of care you can get access to or what you're stuck in for the rest of your life if you are not apprised of what's really going on in Medicare.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned in passing at the beginning part of before we went into these little rabbit holes here, that there's a story out there about how insurance companies are using AI to deny post-acute care to Medicare Advantage seniors. And a Senate subcommittee investigated this and found out some really disturbing things. What did they find out about that?
Well, some of these plans are using technology, and those. So, if a physician does prior authorization, which is of course in Medicare Advantage, that's the only health plan version. So, we're talking about the country's three largest Medicare Advantage insurers, who are using these technologies, and there's about 60% of all Medicare Advantage enrollees that are actually in these plans. And so they're all the potential that when they want access to care, they're not going to be able to get it. And so these three insurers, which are UnitedHealthcare, CVS, and Humana, these insurers were found to deny access to post-acute care at far higher rates than other types of care. And post-acute care is like, you know, I don't know if people realize this, but if you're in a hospital, you're in a hospital for a certain number of days, and then they like to send you to what's called a SNF. You can't think of what the S is, skilled nursing facility. And then that is the post-acute care, and that they were, their denials were 16 times higher than the company's overall denial rate. So really, you know, it looks like they'll take care of you in the hospital, but they really want to send you home, you know, without maybe the care that you need after you've been acutely ill.
Wow. Well, AI is just everywhere these days. And it's, it's like a lot of things. It has good things that you can do with it. But the nefarious side of AI is going to get more and more obvious as time goes on. They're talking about using artificial intelligence instead of nursing care, instead of like physician's assistants and nurse practitioners, even instead of doctors, you know, and they're talking about robotics, you know, and there's more and more robotics being used in surgeries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, AI will... It'll be like HAL. Remember that movie in 1970s?
Yes, HAL.
HAL just kind of like take over the world, you know?
Lock you out.
Exactly.
Time to die.
Really, true.
So, you know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
AI was just in the news because they're talking about a study, or maybe it's even several studies, regarding hallucinations. So that's what they talk about when they talk about AI putting in words and text and entire blocks of text that nobody ever said, that don't even make any sense. And so there is significant hallucination in artificial intelligence. And they were talking about how dangerous that could be when they use it in medical care, because it could give you diagnoses you don't have. It could say that you said things you never said. They said it talked about giving diagnoses, I think, that weren't even there, racial statements that were never, ever said. And the interesting thing in medical care where they're doing it. So they're doing it at a hospital for sure that they talked about in this article in LA, and another one in Mankato, Minnesota, which is only about 2 hours away from our office here. And they're just talking about how, you know, that could be a problem, and how when you are sitting in the exam room with your doctor and there's this virtual scribe picking up every word that you say and transcribing it, and then you're having all of these errors, right? But the audio tapes are immediately erased for safety purposes and security purposes. And so nobody has any idea what was really said, and nobody can check back to see, did that person really say that? You know, did they say they hit their child? I mean, I'm putting that in here, right? I mean, if you're there, they were talking about violence being something that gets inserted into the text. And what if you said something else, but it wrote it as though you said that you hit your child, when you actually said, my child got hurt, you know, or something like that, right? And there's nothing to say that you didn't say that, because the tape is erased. So I encourage people if they're asked, can I tape this, you know, and have it transcribed, to just say no, use your own hand and your own notes, and then you can put it in there. You know, I don't want to be audio taped and then have it be wrong.
Wow. Wow, it's sounding more and more like 1984, isn't it? Well, with Trila, we're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to be right back, because I've got a lot more questions I want to ask you on our monthly update here. So today we're talking to Trila Braze, the president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. We're going to take a really quick break. We'll be right back. We also have an apparel line on our store that has just the best things. In fact, I go and shop at my own store. I mean, I really do go and buy stuff out of my own store. They have t-shirts and sweatshirts and cups and mugs and totes. We've got a great designer. We're always adding new things all the time. And either one of those two product lines, either our private label supplements, our Opti line, the white bottles with the green leaves on it, or with the apparel store, and they're two separate stores. They do not have a single shopping cart. It's like you go in one store and get your groceries and you go to the other store and get your shoes. Well, these are two separate stores, but you can use the same affiliate code. If you use the code podcast, when you go to the checkout, you can get 10% off on everything you buy every time you go to the store. Okay, well, welcome back, everyone. We're talking today with Twyla Braze, the president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. Twyla, I wanted to ask you, you know, of all the things that you know that are on the plate, what do you think about Bill Gates standing trial in the Netherlands? What do you think that, do you think that's going to go anywhere? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that he tried to say that the Netherlands has no jurisdiction over him because he is a U.S. citizen, and the Netherlands said, we disagree. And then the head of Pfizer, Mr. I think it's Burla, he did not contest it. So he is also being brought to trial, and he did not contest that there was no jurisdiction. And so it seems to me that they are serious about this, but where it could lead, I mean, whether it just leads to a black mark on the history of his life or something, or whether it leads to they can't prove anything, I have no idea. But it does seem that they are serious about bringing him to trial.
Yeah, I read a bit about that case and about the plaintiffs. I think there's 9 plaintiffs that are brought him to, and one of them have died, and mm-hmm. one of them can't, you know, is so neurologically vaccine injured, she can't speak. And so her father was speaking for her, and the judge was, you know, really listening and really somber about this. And we don't know about if the judge has somebody in his family that perhaps mm-hmm. because the vaccine injury from these COVID vaccines is so pervasive, mm-hmm. you know, that we don't really know what that is, which brings up the next point I wanted to ask you about. Is I was reading a Substack this morning when I first woke up from Karen Kingston, you know, she's a great researcher, about the failure of the government to stop the COVID shots in this country when there were so many signs of disease, disability, and death that were available in these databases from early on. And what surprised me and what I wanted to ask you about were these databases that I did not realize there were so many and how pervasive they are. There's a Medicare database that 71% of the fully vaccinated Medicare patients got COVID, and 60% of the hospitalizations were in fully vaccinated seniors. Then there's the CDC V-Safe system that has 10 million people in the database, that 40% reported a grade 3 reaction to the COVID shots, which means that grade 3 event is, it means that they were so injured they couldn't perform daily functions, and more than 200,000 had to go to the ER. And then there's this one that is called the BEST database, which is Biologic Effectiveness and Safety Initiative. That the government is required to track vaccines and blood products. And there's 300 million persons in that database, which is almost the whole country. And FDA and CBER really failed to review this. And it's an active database, unlike VAERS, which is passive and retrospective. With those three databases, the Medicare database, the VSafe database, and the BEST database, were you aware of those databases and how they functioned? The only one that I had ever heard of really was the VSafe. But this other one, this BEST database that they are now starting to comb through and finding how many people were severely injured and killed by these vaccines. Were you familiar with all those databases, number one? And number two, are there more that we don't even know about?
I was familiar with the Medicare database because there was something that came out, some study that came out when they were talking about the hospitalizations of the COVID vaccinated, so to speak, right? And I remember learning about it then and being surprised that such a database existed. I haven't really seen anything in the news about it since, so I will be interested in reading her article. The VSafe is interesting because the government shut it down. They didn't take any more reactions. Was it maybe a year ago? Rather than having this amazing database of 10 million people that they could have done long-term research with, they shut it down. And to me, that seems like they didn't want to see. I mean, if you're correct that there's 40% that already have these amazing injuries reported, right? Then they don't want to see the rest of them. I just think they didn't want to see it. They didn't want to have to report it. And so they just aren't taking any more reports. They just quit what they should have done, which was to conduct long-term research on these 10 million people they had recruited. Now, the other one, I have no idea. I didn't know that this database existed, so I have nothing to say about it, but I'm not surprised because the government loves databases.
You know, the thing that is, you know, I had read another stat on another article that I read, this was a couple of months ago, that they said that now there's up to 3,000 articles that are now published on vaccine injury and analyzing these databases and injuries in terms of autoimmune disease and neurological complications and the myocarditis and cardiovascular things. But yet the FDA approved, you know, this season's COVID shot for seniors to be giving a COVID shot, an RSV vaccine, which is just horrible and has horrible side effects to it, and a flu shot all at the same time. And they've still approved it for infants and they're approving it for teenagers. With all of this data showing that this is deadly, that it should have been pulled off the market 4 years ago when they first started having those signals. I remember hearing early on a lecture or maybe just a podcast with Peter McCullough when he said, you know, because Peter, that was one of the things he did when he was back doing the things he did before at Baylor, was he sat on those committees that reviewed these, you know, danger signals on whether it was a vaccine or a drug or a biologic or something like that. That he said, we knew 2 months after the vaccines were released, there were enough data signals then, which would have been June of 2020, that there were enough data signals then to stop it, to pull it off the market and say this is going to be dangerous. And here we are at the end of 2024, approving the next round for seniors and kids and babies and pregnant women and all this stuff. Why aren't they pulling this off the market, number one? And number two, why aren't the people who are still administering these things, shouldn't they be held liable for administering a dangerous drug?
Okay, for the first question, I would say this is all about saving face, I think, and about avoiding liability. So that if they continue to push this as though it is safe, they'll never have to say, we didn't know. And they're hoping that they can get by with it. I just think they're hoping that they can get by with it. I don't know how they're going to get by with it, though, because the vaccine injured cannot be ignored. And the vaccine injured will be, you know, paid for the stories and will have to be paid for. The stories will just keep going and going. The people who get strong enough after their vaccine injury are going to talk about it. You know, what's the name of that young girl who's in Twitter? Where she didn't want to take it. It was a three-way vaccine. I think, was it Alexa or Lexi or?
Oh, yeah. Alexa, yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, I mean, you see the pictures of her, you know, necrotic tissue everywhere, right? And she has survived. But she didn't want to take it, right? But they said she had to take it for, I can't remember what reason.
To get a blood transfusion.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. She was already
compromised and had a hemoglobin of 7, which for the listeners is half of the amount of blood that you should have, a hemoglobin of 7. And they forced her to get these shots anyways.
And she's black because everything is necrosing and right. And her skin is peeling off and she has lost
full
part
thickness.
Of her ears.
It's full thickness.
Yeah. And she's lost her earlobes. I mean, you know, some of these things cannot be denied, but I think, you know, they have their agenda. And they do not want, that's part of why they did COVID in the first place, you know, and denied access to ivermectin, was because their agenda was to make sure that when the government said you had to get a shot, you would get a shot. And ever after, whatever the government said, you had to do. They wanted to set the precedent. Well, they were not successful, but now they've got, you know, people like Bill Gates heading to court. I don't think that's the end of people heading to court, you know, and there was that court ruling, was it just like a week or so ago, about the workers of a railroad. They're getting $1 million a piece, those who were forced to lose their job because they wouldn't take the shot. You know, this is not over by any stretch of the imagination. And now Sidney Powell released an article out of Brownstone Institute by Jay Bhattacharya. And if you look at that article in that Substack, it's a report from the U.S. House of Representatives. And I have the name right up here. I'm going to read it. Here's the name of the report from Energy and Commerce, chaired by Kathy McMorris Rogers, came out in October 2024. And this is the title: We Can Do This, an assessment of the Department of Health and Human Services COVID-19 public health campaign. So I believe that the name of the campaign was We Can Do This. And this is all the money poured into PR, a PR company, to push the shot, to push the masking agenda, to push, you know, everything that got pushed that was a lie. It was a PR firm that our taxpayer dollars were paying for to push everybody into everything that they wanted to happen across the country. It's a really amazing report. I'd encourage anybody to go to Jay Bhattacharya's article in Brownstone Institute on this, because, you know, this is a really big discovery document.
And he kind of split it up and didn't do the full document because it's pretty long, but he did, you know, excerpts out of the document. He put it on X, you know, on Twitter. He put it under on there. So you can, if you want to read kind of like the cliff notes, you know, when you pulled out sort of things, but, but you're right. That is an incredible discovery document that I hope a lot of attorneys will pay attention to and do something with it.
$900 million to do this fake truth, right? Campaign. Yeah.
Fake truth, meaning lies.
Lies. Well said.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're coming down to our last few minutes here, and I want to leave time to talk about your fight to stop the real ID. And that earlier this month, you know, CCHF quickly mobilized. You were on our show last month, and then we helped you to get on a bunch of other shows that then generated other shows and things like that. Where are you? Where is CCHF with that campaign? And for those people who missed that conversation, tell people again why the real ID is such a bad thing.
All right. Well, so I'll tell you where we are with the campaign, and then I'll tell you about the real ID. So the campaign, thank you very much, because that was really helpful to us. Because on September 18th, the day we discovered that this proposed rule on real ID was out there, there were only 63 public comments, and a lot of them were for the real ID. And so by the time it was all over on October 15th, there were 31,764 comments. Yay. And most of them all opposed. That's exactly right. You know, we had only three weeks, and it was in the middle of when our organization was having our fundraising gala. So it was it was an interesting time to do a nationwide campaign to get people to comment on something that they might believe is a good idea. So and so where that goes now is that we are signed up to find out anytime anything happens with that particular proposed rule. So we will see what happens after all of this comment, and whether they intend to begin this progressive enforcement on May 7th, 2025. So next year on May 7th. And this rule said that if you don't get a real ID, they will allow states to do progressive enforcement and progressive consequences, including three strikes and you're out. So you go to the airport three times without a real ID, and the fourth time with children in hand and luggage in tow and tickets, they say, nope, sorry, you gotta go home. So they actually encourage this kind of three strikes enforcement at the state level. Okay, so the real ID, just to know for your listeners to know what the real ID is. The real ID is a system. It is not a card. They talk about the real ID as though it is a card, but you have to understand it as a system of control, command, control, tracking, control of movement, control of access, lots of things that you do freely today. Without such a card, you would not be able to do freely tomorrow without it if they get their way. And so this is a national ID system out of the federal government. It's a usurpation of states' rights. The federal government is taking over identification and the right to drive. But the Real ID can be required for any other official purpose as deemed such by the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. So this is an open door to them making the Real ID system into a social credit system. They want to put it on your phone, just like in China, which has everything on their phones, and China controls what happens to their citizens. They know where their citizens are. They know how far they move. They can control their movements, their buying, their everything, right? And this sets us up for a social credit system in this country, which is why our organization is opposing it. We do know that at a healthcare level, it will be no card, no care. We believe it could be the next thing that they would say that a Real ID was required for, in hopes of getting the American public to bow to this entire system. But here's what I want to say. You can't fly has always been a lie. That's the Obama administration's lie. First of all, the whole system is unconstitutional, wholly unconstitutional. But even if it were allowed, the Department of Homeland Security itself says that there are like 16 different identification documents you can use to fly, including the passport. Now, the passport will not be turned into a social credit system anytime soon. So if you're really afraid that our organization and others will not succeed in this endeavor to stop the Real ID, go get yourself a passport, and so you feel secure that you can fly, and then just refuse to get the Real ID. Do not let a gold star appear on your driver's license or your identification card. Get a standard driver's license and refuse to get the Real ID so they do not get to the tipping point where they suddenly say, okay, we got enough people in, everybody else is in, or you can't get access to anything. That's a bit of an overstatement, but that's where they're going, right? Because that's what the law says. The law says any other official purpose as deemed by the secretary. And the secretary can decide anything they want and call it a national security issue and say, well, we can't have illegal immigrants getting health care, so we'll need to have it for health care. You know, I don't believe illegal immigrants should have health care, but this is how they would push this sort of thing, right? And so so that's what the Real ID is. It's a system. You should do everything to avoid it, to not get it. And if you already have a gold star on your card, go and get a standard driver's license. If you are in the states that allow you to, and there's only 5 states that don't allow you to, I'm going to look at the list. Those states are Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, Texas, and Wyoming. Those states do not allow you to have anything except a Real ID. And you can talk to legislators if you're in those states and say, hey, give us back our right to a standard ID because we don't want a social credit system. And we know this Real ID is not just a card. It's an unconstitutional federal system to control us.
You know, those states are kind of surprising.
I know. Like
Wyoming, Texas, and Florida for sure, you know, because they're kind of some of the more freedom-loving states that we have. And then you said Mississippi, and what was the fifth one?
Georgia.
Georgia. Well, that doesn't surprise me, but...
Yeah.
but that those are, that's particularly Wyoming. You know, Wyoming, you know, that's really kind of surprising. And maybe their legislators just don't know. You know, because I think a lot of people think it's just another ID. They don't understand that it's this entire system leading towards UN enforcement of their treaties and their pact for the future. Here in the United States, it's a way to enforce it, that this is an entire system of control that will lead us to the 15-minute cities, to all the different things that they're trying to implement to us. So
3 pieces of clothing a year. 3 pieces of new clothing a year. That's what they want to do.
Oh my gosh.
So we have an interesting story out of Maryland. Somebody said they couldn't get a non-Real ID in Maryland. And so, you know, I took a look at the law, which says nothing. And I look at the DMV, which says only Real ID. But then I found in their rules, they actually say if somebody wants a non-Real ID license, if they want a, you know, traditional license, blah, 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 blah. And so the DMVs are trying very hard to get everybody into the Real ID, and you really have to know that you have a right not to have it in order to secure it.
Oof. Well, do you think that they were surprised by the outpouring? Like suddenly they went from 63 to 31,000. I mean, those little bureaucrats sitting back there looking at that must have been like, what the heck?
There's a campaign. Somebody's doing a campaign, right? I don't know, but I truly believe that they put that, they proposed it. They gave only 30 days and they did it right before this very heated election. I think in hopes of having the thing just like fly by under the radar. And it would have if I had been alerted by somebody else who figured it out. And then I pretty much knew that there'd be nobody else in the country that would lead a campaign to stop it. And so I just said, I know our event is coming up in 10 days, but I am starting this campaign because this is essential to having a free country. We can't have a national ID and federal control over our movement to have a free country. And so I'm really pleased with everybody who engaged, and I'm so happy with you and what you did to help us get more people and all of your listeners who took advantage of this time to say no to the Real ID, to say it's unconstitutional, and to make it more difficult for them to move towards imposing it. So, you know, this is like a step whatever in the process of opposing it. There will be other things that will have to be done to oppose it, including trying to get state legislators to go back on their compliance, to realize that no, we are not going to comply with Real ID in this state. We are going to tell the DMVs to get rid of all of the data that they have collected on people who have Real IDs, you know, their social security, well, not social security, they probably already have that one, but their birth certificate and all the documents that they have taken, you know, copies of, that they shouldn't be holding those. You know, there's different things that we can do to move it backwards. As a reminder, there are 44 million IDs and driver's licenses that are not Real ID compliant. We need to move that to 46 and 48 and 50% and on up. So we need to reverse this trend towards Real ID and move it back the other direction.
Yeah. And if you've got a driver's license that has a gold star and a Real ID, just say you lost it and you go back to the DMV and get a new one. You know, just that you just, and really, I mean, because that can happen. People's wallets and purses can be stolen and, you know, different things like that, that people lose their driver's license. It's not a uncommon phenomenon. And you just go and you just say, I lost it. I need to get a new one. And when they, and there's a little box that you have to check that says, do you want the Real ID? And, you know, the answer is no. Or you check it if you want it, you know, so just get a new one.
And this just occurred to me this very moment, but if somebody at the DMV says, but you had a Real ID, a really easy thing to say is, I know I did, but I decided I'm going to use a passport instead. Just give me a standard driver's license.
There you go. Absolutely. Well, Twyla, again, this has been wonderful. One last thing I want to say really quick before we close out here is Bobby Kennedy put out a tweet a couple of days ago that said, you know, our freedom of speech is so on the line right now with this election, and that some of the biggest people in the Democratic Party, including John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, both Kamala and Waltz, are both saying on the national and international plane. I heard John Kerry say this at a WEF a meeting, that this inconvenient thing we have of freedom of speech just needs to go away if we're going to be able to maintain control and govern, because freedom of speech is not a right, it's a privilege. And because it's a privilege, the government should go in and cancel all the misinformation, which is really missing information, and disinformation, which is really defined by them. So I need people to really be vigilant to that as they're starting, just because we are guaranteed a constitutionally guaranteed right to free. It is a right to freedom of speech. And they're saying, no, it's not a right. It's a privilege. Watch for that language and make sure that you inform your friends and family that we must maintain our freedom of speech, or all sorts. And this is what Bobby said in his tweet, you know, all forms of tyranny can come from that.
Only communists want to shut down your freedom of speech. And that's really what we're facing in this country. Freedom of speech is the first freedom because it protects all the rest of the freedoms. And so, you know, we need to have freedom of speech. We started on the basis of freedom of speech, and we will still keep freedom of speech unless we're willing to let the communists and the Marxists take over in this country. And personally, I am not willing to do so. So I'm sure your listeners aren't as well. It's so incredibly important. He is so right.
He's so right. Well, Twyla, thank you so much again. Tell people where they can find you and where they can get that Medicare guide. And what else they can do to support your campaigns against the Real ID?
Yeah, so they can just go to cchfreedom.org, cchfreedom.org. And if they want to, you know, continue to find out what we're doing or be alerted as soon as something is happening, we do have a once a month email, and they can just sign up for that at the bottom of the homepage. And of course, they can donate, which we would love. And then they get a donor email in addition to that, which just tells you, you know, what we're doing and gives you more of the inside scoop, I guess. So cchfreedom.org.
Very, very good. And we look forward to having you back again next time. We're so, thank you so much for the generosity of your time. And we do get a lot of play on this because this will be posted on my Substack, which is drtenpenny.substack.com on Wednesdays now. We're posting them up on Wednesdays. They're always out on Cloud Hub. They stay visual there, and there's other places. So we are getting tens of thousands of views and listens to this so that we can get the information out about freedom. So with that, I want to thank everybody so much for joining me. If you've missed any of these things, you can find them on my Substack. You can go to drtenpenny.substack.com. You can become a Substack, you can go to drtenpenny.com, hover over the podcast tab and become a podcast member, which that supports what we're doing too. So with that, I want to close with one of my favorite verses from the Bible. I close all my podcasts with, whether they are live or pre-recorded, which is Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. And so lean into God. He'll never let you down. Mark your calendars till we see you again next week at the Tenpenny Files, same place, same time. Twyla, thank you again so much for being here. And to everyone else, goodbye and God bless.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven Substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.